Is it really true that somehow we are biogenetically hardwired not to feel a sense of care and empathy for those that are different than us? Am I, as an inclusive activist, even potentially subject to this threat? How can I be inclusive if I am hardwired to not care about the pain of certain others? Today's podcast is on the racial empathy gap. Welcome back to the podcast. The last 2 weeks have been really fantastic, and I've been very appreciative of the time that I've had to spend a little bit of quality time in the last few weekends with my friends and my family. It has been really great, and I'm really, really grateful for that opportunity. I'll be going out on a retreat this very next weekend with part of the Emerging Leaders program, so the fact that I've kind of had some moments to spend some time with the people that I love and build myself up, I think really helps. And as far as the podcast updates go, I have had the podcast's first email in the last week, and it was very cool because I was asked to speak on activism and self-care and how to avoid activist burnout. Sadly, I could not go because I had to turn down the opportunity to speak at the We the People Summit, sponsored by some great forward-thinking folks who needed me to come in to talk about some diversity and inclusion activism stuff, but I had to turn that down because of the Emerging Leaders retreats, sadly. But I really appreciate Sarah emailing me and asking me about that opportunity, because this is what that podcast does and looks at specifically. And so I'm going to have to miss that opportunity, but I was really happy to get an actual physical email for the first time in this podcast history. Remember that you too can email me as well at inclusiveactivism@cox.net. That's inclusiveactivism@cox.net. Or you can always leave me a voicemail. Nope, that's a voicemail at 860-576-9393. Again, that phone number, if you're dialing right now, is 860-576-9393. I really enjoy the opportunity to hear you, hear the words in your voice, and try to understand your thoughts and try to find a way to connect with you. But no emails, no voicemails tonight, just emails specifically. Also, remember to please rate and review the Inclusive Activism Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or you can always share the podcast on your social media with friends or family or folks that are just inclusive thinking folks as well. All this stuff goes a long way in making the podcast a lot more visible for other people. Also, please remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, as these are great ways for me to show proof of work to potential sponsors. It would go a long, long way to go to getting my producer, Sarah, paid some point in time in the future, which I'm definitely hoping that that will happen in the near future. So checking in on me and my activism, it's been about 4 meetings since I have joined the opportunity of the Valley Leadership Advance Group, and it is for people that are doing leadership in Arizona but are not yet considered pillars in the community. It's been okay, and I'm seeing now with a little bit more self-facilitation, we might be able to draw some really great outcomes, so I'm seeing some opportunity in that. I also am now scheduled to do some service as part of the Valley Leadership Advance program on November 18th with Habitat for Humanity, which I'm really looking forward to because I've never really done any service with Habitat for Humanity. I think that's a really great idea, especially if you're a homeowner. If you're a homeowner, try to get in to do some service with Habitat for Humanity, because you're going to learn how to do things for your own house as well as make a difference for others. But I'm really looking forward to doing that because I've never done service with this organization specifically. And who knows, maybe this becomes a regular part of my service life activity. I did service last night with Howl-O-Ween. It's a fundraising event with the Phoenix Zoo, which I know can cause some problematics for some people, but overall, it's good, if imperfect, in that the event does help to make and create some conservation efforts across the globe, and it also provides a safe place for Halloween activities for families out there in the world. So again, we're not going to let perfectionism get in the way of making a difference. I don't know many other ways for people to get a sense of what's out there with the world and meet and just be part of nature and understand the opportunity of biodiversity. I do think all zoos have a long way to go as far as like making spaces where all the animals are comfortable and safe and don't just like stay in very small confined spaces. But at the same point in time, I do have a large love of nature, and I do think my love of nature, my love of outdoors, my interest in biology specifically comes from the fact that I got to see so many wonderful documentaries about nature, and I got the opportunity to see some animals at the zoo. There's some animals that only can get back into the community through the zoo. So again, not a giant zoo fan, never going to be a giant fan of anything in cages specifically, but at the same point in time, I do think there's ways to help conservation efforts across the world, and though it's imperfect, I do think they do as best as they can. Now, over the month of November, I am going to be doing a lot of service specifically. I'll be doing service with the Andre House, which is a soup kitchen downtown, the day before Thanksgiving. The day after Thanksgiving, I am planning on being at Feed My Starving Children, packing some food bags, which go all over the world to help a lot of different folks. And I also have planned to be at Habitat for Humanity. But I'm really trying to see what I can do to extend my sense of gratitude throughout the month of November. I want to make a movie playlist of movies that make me feel thankful and grateful for things, because I want to make November a month of appreciation specifically. So if you're choosing to do that, or you want to join me in making November a month of appreciation, call me on the podcast hotline, which is 860-576-9393, and let me know how it's going. Let me know what you think. Let me know how you're feeling. And then you too can be part of this appreciation situation. So my self-care has been pretty good. It's much better than the last time you heard from me. I lifted about 4 times last week, which was 1 short of my goal, but I am dealing with a nagging shoulder injury, which is really limiting me. But I did try to look up some ways that I could correct my shoulder's problem by doing a little bit more body balancing. Like, I think my shoulders are over-rotated forward because of weak rear delts, so I'm going to work on that. I got cardio done 3 times this week, which doesn't happen very often. I'm usually at 2 times a week. I meditated 3 times a week, which is for a period of about 10 to 15 minutes, but I wish my quality was a little bit higher. I'm in the thick of my fall semester, and that sense of busyness is kind of creeping into my mindfulness, so it may be messing up my sense of peace a little bit, but hey, we're in the process. We're all doing what we can, right? I also won my first flag football playoff game this last morning, which means a lot to me because I really enjoy being out there and playing and being with my friends and doing those things that make a lot of difference to me. I think that's something that the generation before Generation X was really good at, as far as like bowling nights or softball leagues, and it's something I think would be healthy for other groups to get into and try, because you have to have a bigger, wider life outside of you and your family at your home. And then lastly, I had my friend Luke Black over last week, and it was very, very good for us to get to see each other, and that he helps keep me active in the community. He pushes me to be a little bit more of an activist, and then I think we help him in trying to find a way to be balanced and joyful as we can manage. So really great synergy with that opportunity there. So moving on to the podcast today, what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about what is the racial empathy gap specifically. Then we're going to talk about some examples of the repercussions of this racial empathy gap. And then lastly, we're going to look at what can we do to overcome this racial empathy gap, given that I experience it and then our country definitely experiences it too. So first, we're going to look at what is the racial empathy gap. This notion comes from a well-documented psychological phenomenon behind what I'd overheard. So there was this person named Morton B. who sent an essay along to Jason Silverstein in which he reviews literature on the racial empathy gap. All things being equal, if you show an image of a dark and light-skinned person being harmed, the person, whoever's watching this, will most likely react more strongly with more empathy to a light-skinned person's pain versus a dark-skinned person's experience of pain. Studies have found evidence using this, both self-reports as well as measures of brain activity. So this is people telling people stuff, as well as noticing areas in the brain that are firing. Now, notably, both white and black people respond similarly with this racial empathy gap. There is less of a experience of empathetic pain in the observation of black bodies being harmed with this racial empathy gap. I posted the article, which is Racial Bias in Perception of Others' Pain, into the podcast notes if you want to read more about this study specifically. But this idea of the racial empathy gap is related to the idea that somehow the darker your skin tone is, the more you can stand and deal with pain. It seems like there is a sense of like they can deal with this difficulty and pain easier. I think some of that comes to with the idea that they lead difficult lives, or that maybe they're just hardier as a people. I don't know what the forefront brain is thinking with this, but I know the back brain is definitely making this thing actually happen. But what makes it notable is that it's not explicit bias specifically, and it's not related to any degree of racial animosity. It doesn't even matter if you are part of that group or not. As I said before, both white people and black people display effects of that racial empathy gap. Instead, it appears to be related to the perception that black people have already had to cope with a great deal of pain from racism, from poverty, from poor health, etc. And as a result, they have a greater pain threshold. This again is that perception. In other words, they are less sensitive to pain because they're seen as hardened or hardy or more resilient specifically, which is kind of sad because you're going to heap more pain on a very pained people. That seems really wrong. Efforts to parse out whether this effect might be due to race specifically or perceptions of whether a person has lived a hard life might suggest that it might primarily be the hard life situation. But again, as author Shelverstein points out, we tend to homogenize the black population and assume that all black people must face adversity. So whether the phenomenon is caused by race or status can be made muddy pretty quickly. So again, the racial empathy gap is the idea that there is a differing sense of empathy for white and black people's pain outside of the race you belong to. Both races experience this phenomenon. Both races feel that black people can endure more pain. So, now that we have a sense of what that is, we're going to look a little bit into what are some examples of the repercussions of the empathy gap. So, one of the ones that I found that I think is one of the better examples is specifically the crack epidemic versus the heroin epidemic. If you want to examine how the working class receives empathy that is never reserved for the black working class, look no further than the notion of the heroin epidemic. Now, admittedly, the heroin epidemic is a terrible health crisis that requires immediate bipartisan solutions. But it is also notable that when crack cocaine disproportionately affected black communities in the 1980s, there was no call for public health as a solution specifically. In fact, the crack epidemic was not considered a public health problem at all. Instead, it was considered a criminal justice issue. Crack cocaine users in the black community were not given clean needles, nor were they given anti-overdose drugs. Instead, they were arrested, given criminal records, as well as mandatory minimum sentences. And those mandatory minimum sentences were a lot different. For example, I think the minimum sentence for an equal amount of cocaine for an equal amount of crack carried either 6 months to 5 years for the same amount, just given the differing forms specifically. Politicians did not call for compassion and sympathy for poor black people caught up in drugs in the 1980s. They called for harsher criminal penalties. Just look at the 100-to-1 mandatory sentencing ratio between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine. Again, that's what I'm talking about, like a huge disparity between the mandatory sentencing ratio for the same amount of drugs, just in different forms. The law was consciously designed to be more harsh against black people who were more likely to use crack cocaine versus the powdered version of the drug. Millions of black people got records, were locked up, lost their voting rights, and were later unable to re-enter the economy or get a job due to the harsh state and local laws passed back in the 1980s. These poor black people used crack cocaine got no sympathy from the media or from politicians, but we are expected to sympathize with poor white people who use heroin and even work overtime to help them avoid the same criminal penalties. So you see how there's victim blaming with one thing, and I would point out that there is some links that in the 70s, there was some intention in putting more crack cocaine in economically distressed black neighborhoods specifically. I don't have the research on that, but it is something that I've seen and heard. Now, here's another example of the racial empathy gap. And this is, there is no economic anxiety, which is used as an excuse for black workers. How many times have you turned on the local news and seen a black person accused of committing a petty crime, such as stealing from a gas station or not paying a parking ticket? How many times have you read a piece of conservative media that called black people lazy or freeloaders or welfare queens? How many times have you seen members of the media or politicians go on an extended riff about black-on-black crimes specifically? Now think about how many times you've heard about economic anxiety used as an excuse for black people for any one of those things. Zero, right? Well, economic anxiety isn't used as an excuse for black people or any other minorities, really. It's almost as though economic anxiety is not supposed to be a black experience phenomenon. Black people, as it is framed in the media, are more supposed to be at the bottom of the social system here in America. We're supposed to be meek and quiet about this caste system, or the fact that black people are over and over again finding themselves at the bottom of the economic social ladder. Even supposed leftists talk almost exclusively about the white working class, spending virtually no time speaking to or working with the black working class or trying to build relationships with them. When they ask us to talk about workers, they're specifically talking about white workers in factories in the Northeast and the Rust Belt specifically. They're never really talking about black communities in South Carolina, North Carolina, or Georgia. Now, all of this happens despite the fact that the median black family has 13 times less accumulated wealth than the median white family. Black people have not turned to racial demagogues to demonize other races and call for attacking them to cure our economic problems, right? You've never heard, well, the problem is all these white people, right, from the black community as far as like ways to fix their economic problems. The black community has not turned to the politics of hate in order to fix our much more pressing and severe economic anxiety needs. Why isn't it economic anxiety ever used as an excuse for black people when we always hear the same narrative for white people? Well, you already have a sense of what that answer is. It's that racial empathy gap. Instead, economic anxiety is reserved as an excuse for significantly wealthier white workers who have espoused support for racist political processes. Nobody is talking about how the black working class has a very real concern for economic anxiety. They are either ignored or they are told that they deserve it. The last example that I wanted to give you for the racial empathy gap is the fact that we need Black Lives Matter at all. The fact that there is a movement called Black Lives Matter shows us that we have some serious problems with the racial empathy gap. The racial empathy gap creates the fact that blacks are 13% of the population, and yet they represent 37% of the total population locked up. And that is bananas. That is a rate of 3 times their own population. Think if white people were in prison at just half the rate of their representation. So they make up 73.6% of the population, but again, they're less than half. They are imprisoned at roughly a 30% rate, roughly. So obviously less than half still, given that there are way more people in society. The racial empathy gap is present with officer-involved shootings. 73.9% of the white population is shot and killed at 49%, right? So again, still less than their overall population, less than half. Now, black people are 13% of their overall population, but are shot and killed at a 24% rate. Again, huge jump there. 30-something percent more, and we're talking about shot and killed, not shot, shot and killed. Black people also are prescribed pain medicines 40% less often than their white counterparts for the exact same problem when in the emergency room. So there's some serious evidence that this is a very, very serious societal problem. So lastly, what are we going to do about it? What am I going to do about it for myself? What are we going to do about it for our country? Well, first off, I think we need to take a moment and really consider exactly how toxic our society must be for something like this to not only exist, but for both white and black people to feel this way and have this experience specifically. What's happening in our collective air that makes this happen? Take a moment to think about the narratives that are repeated again and again and again. The visuals that we must choose to see on a day in and day out basis that makes something like this happen. What does this say about us as a people? Next, what I would do is recommend considering giving a bit more slack in your judgment with news stories or headlines which feature blackness or frames blacks as deserving of their fortunes due to some crime. As we saw before, there is little to no empathy in any societal sense for specifically working class black people, especially compared with the narratives of the struggle of working class whites. Another strategy to overcome the racial empathy gap, one answer may be in memory. In one experiment from a study examining different emotional states on how they impact the empathy gap, researchers found participants who completed a memory task while in pain, so the pain was holding their non-dominant hand in ice water, performed worse on the memory task than participants not in pain. In addition, the pain participants were more likely to attribute their poor performance to factors other than the fact that they had been in pain while taking the test. This research suggests that not only that people in stressful emotional states have a worse memory during that time, but also may not realize they were doing less well in their general actions as a result of being in that pain. It also suggests that memory of these effects are not associated with being in a stressful emotional state, and that your actions and connections with that emotional connection fades really quickly. So in other words, we forget the impacts that our emotions had on how we had acted, and therefore try to attribute our behavior to something other than our emotions specifically. This explains why we cannot automatically empathize with anyone who is an experience in an emotion we have never experienced before. This is because our memory for our experience of that emotion and how it affected us may be impaired or erased. It is important to nurture these memories rather than to suppress these memories, and to try to understand the impacts of our emotions rather than dismiss them, so we can access those memories later and have an easier time making a sense of the emotions of others. This would then thereby avoid some of the effects, the negative effects of that racial empathy gap. And how is this all relevant? We all have to deal with different emotions and different emotional states at different times. We've also definitely interact with different people of different ages, different genders, and different sexual orientations. And divides between different groups that can result in things like racism and sexism are all too common. We will never be able to experience other people's emotions in the same way and at the same time they experience them, or understand how it feels to be a member of a group that we don't belong to. But if being more aware of the emotions that they are experiencing could help us understand them, then this could help us in our daily interactions with one another. The takeaway is this: next time you're in an emotional situation and are about to react to something, take a second and think about whether what you are doing is really something you would like to see yourself doing. In other words, is if this was happening to you, is this a fair and appropriate response? Similarly, when someone else is struggling with a problem, reacting extremely to something that may be emotional for them, ask yourself if you have ever felt in a similar way in a different context. Try to put yourself in that same feeling, but in a different situation. If you can access memories rather than suppress them, then you can recognize the emotion of a fellow person, and perhaps you can help find a way to calm them or address the problem in a better way and actually process through that, whether they happen to be your same age, race, gender, or not. At the very least, you will be able to understand what is going on in their mind and why they are reacting in a certain way. Making sure that we can make an active effort to relate to people rather than just look at their situation from solely our own perspective should go a long way in reducing the empathy gap. Additionally, I would also say we really need to expose yourself to different people and not only hang out with people exactly like you. There are some really, really deep internal implicit biases at work that help create this problem. And it is only through exposure to different people, different understandings, different ways of thinking that we can start to undo those deeply held biases. We need to try to put ourselves in other situations firsthand to really understand the difficulties and pains of others' experiences specifically. Now, sitting back and judging and just not trying to get a sense of what black-on-black crime is or the difficulty of the black working class and judging from your own seat, from your own perspective, isn't going to help you, and it's not going to let you connect with other people. And I would also say this way of thinking, this way of undoing this racial empathy gap, I think also is going to help us connect with other people that have different thinking to us. It's about Thanksgiving time, which means it's also about Christmas time, which means it's family time. And it's going to be time to be around people that are really, really different from ourselves, that might hold really different views from us. And it takes a lot of patience to deal with folks that have a very fixed mindset, that don't put themselves in the seats of others to understand their perceptions. But I think we can connect with those people that think differently with us too, by thinking about why do they think and feel the way they do. So when invariably a conversation about the wall comes up over this Thanksgiving, maybe sit back and think about what is the concern that a wall would fix. Maybe if a conversation about Confederate statues come up and people are worried about losing history, you can talk about history, really talk deeply about history, talk about why they love history, share some facts about history, talk about the truth of history, really explore this historical concern in many different ways with them. Come in prepared to think and have a discussion from their framework, right? And when people talk about other people coming and taking all of our jobs, you can be ready to have a conversation about the fact that automation is coming. There is a burger flipping robot that exists already. There's a robot right now that goes through Walgreens and it scans the shelves to see if they need to be restocked. And there's also a driverless truck being produced by Elon Musk and his Tesla company that's going to replace many, many over-the-road trucking jobs, which is one of the bigger jobs that employs more and more people across America. That's the conversation you might want to have, rather than a conversation about refugees or immigrants stealing or taking jobs. So in review, The main review, the main major points of this podcast were, we defined the racial empathy gap. Point number two is we gave some examples of where this racial empathy gap might be creating problems currently for us in our society together. And number three, we looked at the idea that we need to take some time and understand the lives and experience of people, all other people, if we're going to reach across not only this racial empathy gap, but any empathy gap that we have with other and another outgroup person. We need to find a way to connect and overcome all of our collective racial empathy gaps, all of our empathy gaps in general, but specifically this racial empathy gap. I was having a conversation with my partner about the racial empathy gap specifically, and we were looking at horror movies, and I noted that the main person experiencing trauma in a horror movie over the course of all of the horror movie is never a black family. It's usually never a Mexican family. It's usually always white people. And I was wondering, does the fact that white people or black people in different horror movies create some of this stuff? And why don't we see or experience things differently? Why aren't there horror movies which targets black people? Now, I know Get Out is one, but I mean, that's like the one. There's never just like a black family being terrorized by ghosts. We never see that. We never like look at that through the lens of blackness. Is that part of the racial empathy gap? Do we only see and hear certain narratives over and over again for very specific reasons or outcomes? Or is it just that people in power aren't used to hearing or trying to look at the world in a different way? I don't know. It was something interesting and I wanted to throw it in the podcast. And so finally, if this podcast made you think of something, if you have a question or if you have a critique or if you want to get my thoughts on an idea, you can call me at 860-576-9393. Again, that phone number is 860-576-9393. That is a space for you to talk back, to ask me questions, hit me with different scenarios, get a sense of how I might react to something in real time. And depending on how good your stuff is, I might even make it the subject of an entire podcast in the future. But again, we're all going through this process of trying to use diversity and inclusion as a way of personal leadership, and we're all trying to build ourselves as inclusive activists specifically. So that voicemail line, that email at inclusiveactivism@cox.net is us. It's a way for us to create a dialogue about these things, and I think that's what's going to make this podcast amazing in the future, is the fact that we can dialogue about this back and forth. And lastly, if you are interested in bringing me and booking the power of inclusive activism to your organization, you can always do so at inclusiveactivism@cox.net, or you can learn more about me, about Sarah and this organization at www.inclusiveactivism.com. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you in a couple weeks. We'll be right back.